Welcome to Conversations on the Runway, the Australian Air Force's podcast series. Through a series of episodes, we vector in leading thinkers and professionals for a conversation targeting key areas of air and space power, the physical and virtual domains, the strategy, the technology, the challenges, and the people bringing it all together. Today's episode is part of our Space Power series with host Michael Veach. So grab a brew and tune in to today's conversation on the runway.
So it's that scene, that classic scene from the old Western. Yes, I know I like to bend my openings of conversations on the runway into an arguably convoluted Wild West analogy, but just go with me on this. We're in the saloon. Honky-tonk music is playing on the piano. There are men seated at the bar, drinking whiskey, minding their own business. There's the barman, behind the bar, polishing glass with a tea towel. There's lots of glass back there, mirrors, rows of bottles. It's kind of fancy. The barman is usually bald but with a moustache, always wears suspenders for some reason. Then suddenly, the swing doors part and in walks, head to toe in black, the bad guy. The honky-tonk music stops. Instantly, he sees his quarry, one of the guys seated at the bar. His eyes narrow. I guess that'd be a close-up. Slowly, people get up, gravitate away from the door, as well as the seated man, the only one now still at the bar. But he ignores the bad guy, takes another nonchalant swig of his drink. But we all know what's about to happen. And in a terrible moment, the barman sees the destruction of his bar, his business, his livelihood, the social centre of his small frontier town in, I don't know, Montana or somewhere. No one will benefit from the place being smashed up, particularly him and the people who rely on him. So what does he do?
Howdy, stranger, he offers nervously. Anything I can get you?
From what we've been discovering over the past few weeks on Conversations on the Runway, this to me seems to be something like what space is becoming. A place that we're coming to rely on so much for everything, communications, entertainment, weather, disaster relief, that it's now a really fragile environment. And like the bar in the small town, the consequences of it being smashed up are huge. But who's going to talk the gunfighters down? Is it the barman's job? Is it up to the rest of us in that bar? And in the real world, who's that? Governments? The UN? Elon Musk? And in any case, are we even now too late? Are the gunslingers already on their way to start an interstellar fight that's going to have very serious consequences for the way we live on Earth? International cooperation in space, is it the universe's biggest oxymoron or a statement of hope for the future? On Conversations on the Runway this week, we're looking up and asking who's playing up there and what can we do to make sure they play nice? We have two wonderful guests today who, while they might not necessarily go with my Space Wild West thing, have thought long and hard about space and how to make it safe for everyone. Beaming in via satellite, appropriately enough, from Washington, D.C. in the United States, Victoria Sampson is the Washington Office Director for Secure World Foundation with more than 20 years of experience in military space and security issues and has also served as a senior analyst for the Center of Defense Information and has written prolifically for some of the world's finest publications on matters space. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you. Looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. And please welcome back to the runway Dr. Cassandra Stierce, Senior Consultant and Lecturer specialising in space law and space policy at the Australian National University College of Law and Mission Specialist with the ANU Institute for Space. Hello once again, Cassandra.
Hi, great to be back again.
Victoria, since you've either stayed up late or got up early and are speaking live from America, I will start with you. Is space becoming that fragile saloon bar where the consequences of conflict are very serious indeed?
Well, space has always been a place of competition. You think about the beginning of the Cold War, it was the U.S. and Soviet Union fighting for eternal supremacy. And so I think that some people tend to think things have changed a little bit. What has really changed is that we depend so much on space. And the use of space is really changing. The actors in space are changing. And we're seeing a real increase, both in the number of actors, the number of users, and the number of potential space weapons.
Is our reliance indeed, I'd actually say go further, say dependence on space, and with all these other actors coming into the, coming onto the stage, and our uses for space increasing exponentially, growing aware of human activities, it just seems to me, Victoria, almost axiomatic that a future conflict between mankind will have to happen in space. Is this a scenario that keeps you awake at night?
Well, I mean, I think nothing is definite. So here's our chance to try and prevent that scenario from happening. But I think it is definitely a possibility that there could be some sort of conflict on Earth extending up in space, or some sort of interference in space capabilities, escalating a misunderstanding and misperception on the ground that could then lead to conflict. And so the two are definitely intertwined.
Indeed. I wonder if it keeps, I'm jumping ahead a bit because it seems to me that the commercial national interests of space are becoming very blurred. Is it something that you think keeps Elon Musk awake, the idea of conflict up there?
You know, actually, I really hope it does, because for years when we talked national security issues in space, you know, the commercial actors would be like, whoa, I'm just here to make a buck. You know, I don't have to deal with these national security issues. But the state and the stability of the space domain absolutely does affect them. And in fact, the commercial actors have a strong effect on the national, on the security of space themselves. You know, there's about 3,200 active satellites currently. If you look at all the satellites that are supposed to be launched, not probably won't all, but a good chunk of them will be, but supposed to be launched for the mega constellations over the next 10 years, that's 107,000 satellites. So you're seeing a huge increase in the number of satellites. Who's launching those satellites? It's not state actors. It's
commercial. Can you give us that number
actors.
Again? I'm have to pick myself slightly up off the floor, Victoria. What was that number of satellites that'll be up there in?
We're going to currently about, and again, it changes all the time because you know, SpaceX keeps launching satellites. But let's say about 3,200 active satellites, roughly currently.
Wow!
And if you look at all the satellites that have been asked to have FCC filings, which they need to do to get broadcast rights. There could be 107,000 satellites by 2029. And so that's just a huge potential for threats, for misunderstanding, you know, just from a space traffic management perspective, all the launches coming up, going up and coming back down, all the trash that could be created. And plus you have the problem that these are commercial actors happening, doing these activities.
Yes.
And yet, how do you deal with security issues when it's commercial actors that are holding the reins, so to speak?
Well, you've actually written about the potential for non-state actors to carry out some counter-space cyber operations without national state assistance, which kind of does, and I've made the analogy a couple of times, move into the area of what science fiction talks about, sort of private corporations having enormous leverage in space and space defense. Are we seeing that already, Victoria? Is the line between national space interests and commercial space interests becoming very blurred?
Oh, it definitely is becoming blurred. Just because the line between national security space, commercial space, civil space, it's definitely blurred because you have, you know, commercial satellites carrying national security payloads. You have commercial satellites carrying communications for national security actors. It's happening all the way around. And so it's really hard to say that one is not going to affect the other. I think there's definitely... they're all on the same spectrum. There's continuity between them.
Cassandra, communications, entertainment, weather prediction, disaster relief and amelioration. Do you think we can now with confidence add to this growing list of human uses for space, national security?
Absolutely. And as Victoria said, space has always been a domain in which national security has been at play. So, you know, Sputnik was a military satellite. And then the US, in response, launched essentially military satellites as well. The main original purposes for satellites was to observe each other. The Soviets and the US wanted to observe each other's nuclear programs in particular, to be able to track from space, from a higher observation point, whether there were nuclear detonations and tests going on, being able to observe by literally taking photographs from space, to observe each other's arms stockpiles and that kind of thing. So it's always been really a key role for space has been national security. And I think what we've seen is a kind of resurgence in the importance of space for national security in the last couple of decades because of how dependent we are on space and because of how dependent modern militaries are on space. And so if you want to take out the eyes and ears of your adversary, a really effective way to do that is to just even just temporarily impact their satellites rather than having to attack something on the ground.
And to that, the notion of conflicting space, counter space capabilities has developed its own nomenclatura. I've been trying to get my head around it. I wonder if we could have just a couple of thumbnail sentences about the five categories that counter space capabilities seem to fall under: direct descent, co-orbital, electronic, directed energy, and cyber. Victoria, just pick a couple of those, and could you explain to me what they mean? Direct descent and co-orbital, for example.
Sure. Well, direct descent is, I think, what a lot of people think about when they hear about space weapons. It's something that's being launched from Earth to directly intercept or hit a satellite in orbit. So, you know, a missile launching from the ground going up to hit a satellite. Whereas co-orbital is more the idea that something is put in orbit and then maneuvers once it's on orbit to hit its target.
Uh-huh.
And then we have different options as well. There's directed energy, weapons that use focus energy, such as lasers,
okay,
to interfere or destroy space systems.
Yeah,
it's not as Buck Rogers up here. Electronic warfare, where you have radio frequency interference, basically jamming. And then, of course, cyber. So there's a whole host of ways in which you can interfere with another person's, another entity's space capabilities.
Is the notion of that, what was the movie where the aliens come and smash the place up, 20 years old, where they actually put a virus into an alien ship, is it theoretically possible to infect a moving satellite with a virus to take it out of action?
Michael, I believe you're referring to Independence Day.
I really like that film too. In a silly kind of way.
I mean, the thing is, cyber attacks are relatively easy to do in that, you know, you don't necessarily have to get into orbit. You can have a cyber attack on a ground station. You can do some sort of cyber attack where you manipulate data as it's coming back down. You think about it, a lot of these, especially the national security satellites, they're big and they're old. They've been up there for a while. And, you know, think about how often your computer goes through software updates. Now, once the satellite's up there, yeah, you really can't do that. And so it becomes a real challenge to be able to keep up with that. Now, thankfully, the most important satellites tend to be, you know, protected from that sort of thing. But, I mean, you have a whole system where you're getting capabilities from other actors in the commercial sector. And at any point during the supply chain, you can have some sort of interference or some sort of cyber or malware or something like that put in. And so it definitely is within the realm of possibility. The other thing is that it's easy to deny and it's hard to attribute. And so it's seen as a very attractive option for people to attack other people's space capabilities.
So there's something that Victoria highlighted there that I think is really important to make clear is that satellite systems or space systems are made up of three segments. So you have the satellite in space, you have a ground station, and then you have the link between them, so the communication between them. And that means there's actually three points, three physical, although I guess the link between them isn't physical, but three points at which a space system could be vulnerable. And so a cyber attack could be into the satellite itself. It could be the link between it, like interrupting the communication between the satellite and the ground station, or it could be the ground station itself, which is targeted. And so when we talk about direct descent weapons, those are actually, they've been tested in you know, quite contentious situations. They create an enormous amount of space debris. So they are actually the least desirable form of weapon because space debris is bad for everyone. You can't contain what happens with space debris, and it's going to impact your own satellites as well and cause a risk for your own satellites. So direct descent is the least desirable from every party's perspective. And these other kind of soft kill attacks like jamming the signal or spoofing a signal or a cyber attack are much more desirable because they have less physical impacts and you can be more targeted about what it is you're trying to interrupt. For what purpose and where, and usually for how long as well. But it could be any one of those three segments.
We're assured that only non-kinetic capabilities are being used presently. What's meant by that, and can it last?
Well, non-kinetic is just basically what Cassandra just said, the idea that it's a cyber attack or it's some sort of jamming, something that essentially does not create an active, you know, debris on orbit. And so the thing is, everyone jams. It is seen as an extremely usable way of interfering with other people's space capabilities. And so the concern is, where is the red line? What point does it escalate things? And it's really hard to say. There have been some discussions about this, but in the international fora, but they haven't come to an agreement. And the other thing is, you know, the idea that possibly lasing, using a laser against satellites to temporarily blind the satellites, that's pretty effective because all you need to do is shoot up a brief laser. It interferes with the satellite taking information from its optical lens and then, you know, turn off the laser and you're done. The problem is the line between dazzling, as in temporarily interfering with the satellite's ability to collect data optically, and blinding, i.e. permanently creating that issue. It's hard to know and it's hard to figure out where you've crossed that line.
I think, we're assuming that future conflicts won't involve vast armies meeting on battlefields. So that notion of warfare is looking more and more sort of an antiquated one. However, and wars will look different and not necessarily being fought between nation states. Of course, We've been at war for a couple of decades now with a non-state organisation such as terrorism. Space would seem to me the ideal environment for terrorism. I'll ask both of you, the scenario of a terrorist organisation wanting to leverage what's known as the Kessler syndrome, where you virtually take us back to the dark ages by wiping out things like satellites and destroying communications and other essential services. This surely must be something that space defense is looking at, not just looking at what other countries are doing, but what other even individuals are doing.
Yeah, Cassandra, I'll let you go.
I actually think it's a lesser threat. And if we are looking at terrorists or non-state actors being able to access this kind of technology, it's unlikely that it's going to be a terrorist group with access to a expensive and very complicated technology for a direct descent weapon to target a specific satellite and blow it up and create space debris. And if they did, again, you know, non-state actors are dependent on space services as well. We all use it for our 21st century lives several times a day, possibly hundreds of times a day. And so it's not really in anyone's interest to create a really problematic space environment, physical space environment. But I do think there's probably greater risks of non-state actors, insurgents, potentially terrorist groups wanting to interrupt. And that's part of the asymmetrical question, right? As a non-state actor or a terrorist group, you don't have to have access to an enormously well-armed artillery. What you do have to have access to is technology. And because the biggest militaries are the most dependent on technology, they're most dependent on space-based technologies. If you do have the capacity to undertake a cyber attack, then you can have a greater impact than trying to blow something up. So that is a question in terms of definitely cyberspace security, potentially some of these soft kill attacks as well. But I think the bigger issues really are the competition between the biggest states. We're going back to a multipolar competition, and that's where I see the biggest tensions lying, although I don't know if Victoria agrees with me on that.
Well, indeed, I was going to add that the US, not surprisingly, has traditionally possessed the most advanced space situational awareness capabilities, but these are being challenged. where are the challenges coming from? And is it like that era before the First World War, where you have nation states worrying about becoming the have-nots of military power? Are there space weaponry have-nots worried about their status, Victoria?
Yeah, I think there are some that are concerned that we could see some sort of replication of what happened with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who are fortunate enough not to be familiar with the NPT, basically it was signed in 1970 and it created two sets of states, nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states. And essentially, if you had tested a nuclear weapon up to that point, or that treaty being signed, then you were a nuclear weapon state. And if you were coming in after that, you were a non-nuclear weapon state. And there are several states that have tested nuclear weapons afterwards that are considered pariahs. And they're like, hey, look, we didn't sign the NPT. It's not fair that we weren't included. If we had tested ahead of time, we would have been grandfathered in. So there is concerns of some states that if there is some sort of agreement or some sort of legally binding treaty or even just some sort of agreement not to test further kinetic energy ASAT tests, for example, anti-satellite tests, then they might be left behind or they might... they might not get the prestige that they think you can get from having a space weapons program. In my opinion, I think Cassandra really hit the nail on the head with that discussion about competition. It seems that now, you know, to be a global power, it's not enough to have a space program, a civil space program. It's not enough to have your own space agency. It's not even enough to be able to launch your own satellites, which, you know, there's over 80 countries that have satellites, but maybe only about a dozen or so that can launch them. Now, it seems that this perception is growing. To be a really powerful global entity, you need to have a space weapons program or counter space capabilities. And that concerns me.
And to the regulation of that, Cassandra, you've spent a very good time exploring and explaining space law. Let me speak to our old mate, the devil, for a moment by proposing, are we not kidding ourselves in thinking that space can never be anything but inherently and completely ungovernable?
I don't think so. It already is governed, and this is a point that I've raised in some of our previous discussions in other episodes, is that space already is governed, and to a certain extent, successfully. So the Outer Space Treaty from 1967 is a framework treaty. It operates like a constitution. It has some core general principles. They are general in nature, but they're core principles which, you know, space actors have adhered to in the decades since we've been in space, which is that you can't appropriate space. There's no claim of sovereignty, that there shall be cooperation. There generally is cooperation, despite everything we're discussing today, that space should be used for peaceful purposes. And then you might question, because we've also just said that space has always been used for military purposes and national security purposes, how can that possibly be peaceful purposes? Well, a very quickly consensus interpretation of that principle emerged, which is that you can use space for military purpose as long as those are not aggressive. So not against, you know, Article 2.4 of the UN Charter prohibits the use of force, and any use of force that isn't authorized by the Security Council or isn't used in justified self-defense is prohibited and is considered to be aggression. And we haven't seen anything like that in space. And I think even with the tension around counter space capabilities and, you know, the need to be able to protect one's space systems. And, you know, in the parlance that we hear quite often is to deny access or deny access of your adversaries to your space assets. Then, so even with that, we still haven't seen any aggression in space. I don't think we're likely to see aggression happen in space in the near future. It is quite likely, as Victoria said, that if we have terrestrial warfare, which is already supported by space-based systems in a really integral sense, that might extend into space. But that still doesn't mean that it's ungovernable. I remain rather optimistic in that. I think there's enormous tensions right now, and we need to clarify more things. We need to take more steps. But for instance, the project that's been mentioned a few times in this podcast series already, the Woomera Manual on the International Law Applicable to Military Space Operations, that is an attempt to clarify how the rules around the use of force, the rules around the law of armed conflict, how they would apply in the space domain. And once we have more clarity on that, we have less risk of those miscalculations and those escalations that Victoria mentioned. But the, you know, I think the biggest challenge is arms control. Like that is the most difficult thing to govern in space.
Well, I mean, the accumulation of counter space capabilities surely constitutes a space arms race, does it not?
Yeah, I think we're in a space arms race. Victoria, you seem to pause on that, but I think we're in one.
Yeah. I agree that there's competition. I don't like the idea of a race because what's your end goal? I mean, when there was a race to the moon, that was pretty clear. What's your end goal? We want to get to the moon. But a space arms race, how do you know that you've won? I think we're going to keep seeing as spirals going up and up and up as tensions increase, but there's no definite endpoint. Actually, you know, I take it back because I feel like recently over the past year or so, there has been a race back to the moon. And you know, everything comes back again. There are a lot of people in the U.S. national security community who are very concerned about, let's be honest, Chinese intentions. And some of that, I think, is how we tend to view everything being done by others as signs to the United States. I do not share that perspective. I don't think necessarily other countries do everything as a mean to signal to the United States. They may have their own domestic interests.
That's the traditional prism, isn't it, by which many countries look through what they perceive to being adversaries in all sorts of theatres. To the UN and trying to keep a lid on all this, 21, I believe, different UN guidelines, do these guidelines have to divide themselves up into military and commercial applications?
So those guidelines were adopted last year, the guidelines on long-term sustainability of outer space. And those guidelines are really about what is it to be a responsible actor in space? So there's no division between military and civilian or commercial in those guidelines. The guidelines are really stating things to do with making sure that there is a space debris mitigation plan. When you launch something into space, what are you going to do at the end of its life? Are you going to deorbit it? Are you going to save some fuel to deorbit it? Are you going to move it into an so-called graveyard or unusable orbit? Building that kind of thing into satellite design, taking care of things like the impact of space weather on satellites, because if you can do that, you can also reduce another piece of space debris because you can keep your satellite going for longer. And making sure that these kind of values are integrated into organizations that are active in space. So that goes whether you're a military or a commercial actor. Everything we're putting into space, we have to think about the long-term impact, particularly in light of what Victoria said, that we're going to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of satellites in a very short time.
But to put my devil's hat back on just briefly again, what's the point of these guidelines if they can't be legally binding or enforceable?
Well, let me jump in there. I have a real bias towards these guidelines, largely because my boss was the chair of the working group that negotiated them. So we're big believers in the guidelines at Secure World Foundation. But I liked them before he became my boss. The thing is, the long-term sustainability guidelines were agreed upon, as Cassandra said, last year at the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, or COPUS. The UN has divided up discussions of space issues and civil space, i.e. COPUS, and then security space, the Conference of Disarmament, UN General Assembly. And so the guidelines themselves were agreed to by the 95 member states of COPUS. And so that includes countries like the United States, Russia, China, Iran, you know, Brazil, a wide variety of space actors. And they all agreed to these 21 guidelines, which, yeah, that's encouraging. And having said that, as you said, these guidelines are only good as they're being implemented. And I think it's more important to say, how do you implement these guidelines? Really, whether or not it's a legally binding treaty or if it's just a resolution you sign on to at the United Nations, if you're not going to carry it out, it doesn't make any difference. And so that's where the real discussion is taking place now. How do you get countries to carry out these guidelines? And a lot of times it's a matter of these countries having the domestic capability of being able to do it. There are a lot of new space actors that don't have that capability yet.
It's something that the Australian Space Agency is looking at right now. It's developing its roadmaps as to what kind of policies it should be putting in place, how it can support space industry. And obviously, space industry does a lot to support military activities in space, so to support Australian defence. And in those roadmaps, the Space Agency is looking at, well, how can we implement those guidelines? How can we demonstrate that we're being a responsible space actor, particularly given the fact that we're seen as a new entrant? We've been active in space for quite some time, but we're seen as a new entrant in the sense of upping our game and now having a space agency. But I agree with Victoria, it's down to how states, countries implement that at a domestic level. The reason that there has been more of a push towards non-binding guidelines rather than treaties is because, you know, as Victoria pointed out, all the countries she mentioned are in very tense relations with each other, and it's really hard to get them around at a negotiating table. And there have even been some proposals to put treaties in place preventing the placement of weapons in outer space, or arms control treaties. And there is just a very uneven political desire to enter into those kind of treaties right now.
Cassandra brings up a very good point. The problem you run into is you can't solve a problem until you agree what the problem actually is you're trying to solve. And when you have these discussions at the multilateral level in the United Nations, you have a split as to what the actual threat is to the security and safety of space. The U.S. and its allies tend to look at it almost as like an environmental cluttering. You know, so many satellites, you have space traffic management, you're running out of space. You know, it almost becomes an environmental issue. Whereas Russia and China tend to look at it as they see the biggest threat as actual weapons placed in space. And let's be honest, space-based interceptors is part of a missile defense program. And so it's been tough because when you try to have these discussions, they're coming at it from entirely different perspectives. And so that's why I think it's been helpful to get off this wagon wheel of are you a treaty or no treaty, where it's kind of a binary discussion about this, and talk more about, as Cassandra said, responsible behavior, whether or not that's treaty-based or what have you. What do you think is actually going to make space more stable and predictable? I think that will be better for international security than anything else.
And it is good to hear your delightful 7-year-old daughter fervently agreeing with you in the background, Victoria.
She does so love space.
You have taught her well, and don't worry, we are very family friendly here on Conversations on the Runway. I note many attempts of the United Nations over the years to build very complex and kind of nifty acronyms around peace in space. The UNIDIR, the Institute for Disarmament Research, has long been speaking of PAROS, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space. But I do know that one of their first resolutions passed, I think back in the early 80s, was to effect an effective and variable agreement to prevent anti-satellite systems. That was at the very beginning. That's not really working out too well, is it?
It's not, but it comes down to what Victoria just said about the problem of defining what it is that you're talking about. And as technology has moved and has advanced, and counter space capabilities look different than they might have done in the 80s, it's become even more difficult to define that. So the PAROS movement, I guess you could call it, the Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, the General Assembly adopts annually, pretty much the same resolution almost annually, in which they state that there is a desire to see a prevention of an arms race in outer space. The General Assembly resolutions are not binding, of course. So what it is a really important reiteration every year of the vast majority political opinion and concern about what's going on in space. And that has a value in and of itself. It's not a legal instrument, but it's a very important statement that comes out. And then under the PAROS, we've had a few different attempts. So the Chinese and Russian, China and Russia have been put forward a joint proposal a couple of times in 2008, again in 2014, for a treaty on the prevention of placement of weapons in outer space, the PPWT. And so, as Victoria said, their concern is very much about weapons in space. And there are others who are more concerned about, if you can't define what a space weapon is, which is what a PPWT would require, because you can't always verify that what's being launched, that might be stated that it's being launched as a communications satellite that then gets repurposed or then spawns a smaller satellite, which has a different purpose in space. It's very difficult to verify. It's very difficult to define. And the US has been pushing back against that consistently, stating that one of the biggest problems is verification, but also making quite clear that they don't really want to enter into a treaty, a binding treaty on this matter. We've had other attempts. So the UN has established a group of government experts, which met last year to discuss, well, what potential practical steps can be taken? Should we be talking about some kind of treaty or not? Should it be a Paros treaty? Should it be a treaty talking about reducing arms that can be used in space, even if they're not space-based? Again, the US pushed back against that as well. They just seem to be very unwilling to enter into a binding agreement. And that's because ambiguity serves them well and serves many states well. Having a lack of clarity about exactly what is prohibited and exactly what is permitted is in their interest at the moment.
I will say that actually just a couple months ago, the United Kingdom released a resolution that they're doing with the United Nations, where they're basically asking all countries to submit a report to the Secretary General. What do they actually think is a threat to space security? And that's an attempt to try and get us all on the same page. So I'll be very curious to see what comes out of that. It could be potential to be a logjam breaker.
You've written, Victoria, about the lack of progress on developing norms of behavior in space. I suspect that's a polite way of agreeing with my premise that's ungovernable. But is one of the major problems what the UN describes as the, quote, inherently opaque nature of space military activities?
Well, I think it's a matter of space is inherently dual use. It's not necessarily the technologies that are threatening, it's what you do with them. And so fact of the matter is, like, how do you demonstrate good intent? How do you demonstrate benign actions? Sometimes you can do that by putting out a policy, or sometimes you can do by sharing space situational awareness, the idea you're sharing information what's happening up in the domain. But other times it's not very clear. And so that's why I think there's been a move towards identifying what these responsible behaviors are that I think can be very helpful. And the interesting thing for me is that the commercial sector is almost leading the way. There have been at least three documents that have come out over the past year or so by consortiums of commercial actors saying, this is what we think is considered responsible behavior and we will bind ourselves to this. And you think, you know, commercial actors are voluntarily taking on these restrictions on their behavior, then it must be something that they're ready to sign on to. And I feel like it's something that states could learn from.
To return just quickly to what Cassandra was alluding to before, the blocking of the United States in some aspect. I note that China and Russia actually did submit a joint working paper on the preventing of the use of weapons in outer space. Firstly, why did they team up?
I mean, China and Russia have a lot of shared interests, right? As two of the five permanent members of the Security Council, there's often alliances sought on certain issues because Security Council members have, of course, a right to veto on resolutions. And so there's often political alliances sought around a lot of issues. China and Russia have a lot of shared interests in pushing and get back against what's perceived as, or I think could be understood as, very much a Western dominance on a lot of issues around international security, international peace, who has certain rights in certain regions. And because, as Victoria said, they really are focused on the threat of weapons in space. And so, as I mentioned, that treaty hasn't gained a lot of support, but what it has sparked is a bigger discussion about, well, do we want a treaty or not? There have been other initiatives also that were also, first of all, initiatives by China and Russia, which have been followed by some states, which is an encouragement for states to make a statement that, which is a unilaterally binding statement, stating that they will never be the first country to place weapons in space. Because if every state promises that, well, then the idea is no one will be the first, so no one will do it.
That's a familiar clause in peace treaties going back hundreds of years, isn't it? We won't be the first to pull the trigger.
Exactly right.
Yeah, the implication is that, of course, they will be happy to be the second. The U.S. doesn't support no first use for nuclear weapons, and the U.S. definitely does not support no first placement. It seems it's I think that the idea is that it's being put up as a straw man to make the U.S. look bad, to be honest.
Well, did the U.S. actually put up a counterproposal of their own, Victoria, to this joint China-Russia submission?
No, and that's been the frustrating thing as an outside observer watching these discussions, is that I think there's a lot of problems with Russian and Chinese suggestion in the PPWT, but the United States has not done any kind of counter. The argument for years was that, well, there's no arms race in space, therefore we don't need space arms control, therefore we don't need a BPWT. And over the past couple of years, there's been a growing acknowledgement that there is competition in space. But when they say, okay, what do you have to counter the PPWT, the Russian and Chinese proposal, the U.S. has not had a lot to offer in return. You really can't fight something with nothing. And so I think these discussions at the International Forum of looking at what is considered to be responsible behavior, I think that's an acknowledgement that the United States cannot have freedom of action for itself, but not, but everyone else has to limit themselves. I think it's recognition that space is so important to the U.S. national security infrastructure that we need to figure out, okay, there need to be some boundaries for actions, and we need to be able to sign onto them ourselves in order to make sure others abide by them too.
It's interesting too, in terms of, now we have the U.S. Space Force. So something that was debated for well over a decade and which finally gained traction under the current administration. And part of its justification has always been, well, there's sufficient threat by other players, in particular Russia and China, in terms of a threat to space systems, part of which includes space arms. And so on the one hand, there's been this rhetoric, well, it's not really an issue, we don't want a binding treaty around it. On the other hand, there's been a justification, oh, but other players really are a threat to the US, that's why we need a space force. So I see it a little bit of cherry picking in terms of the rhetoric, depending on what action or what institution the US wants to support. The US isn't the only one that does cherry picking, of course. But now that we have a space force, and now that the US has made very explicit statements in its policy, in its recent strategy released in July this year, other states, in particular China and Russia, read that as a direct threat. And so when we see news items about, Russia has once again recently tested a potential anti-satellite weapon, and that's such a threat to the US and its allies, I think we also have to see it from the other perspective, which is, the fact that there is Space Force, the fact that there's this rhetoric is raising the tension, is an escalatory thing in and of itself from the perspective of other states.
And Victoria, since one of your eminent articles carries the delicious title "Make Space Great Again," noted, what is your take on what Cassandra's just said?
Oh, I mean, I agree with her. I think it's been interesting seeing how many other countries suddenly decided they wanted a space force when the U.S. officially came out with our own space force. The Russians and Chinese did have sort of an equivalent of space force, but over the past year or so, the Indians stood up something. The Japanese stood up something. The French stood up something. My organization actually had a conference, and we entitled a panel session, "Everyone Wants a Space Force," because it seems like everyone does. Mm. And again, I think it goes back to the idea that if you're really trying to make sure space is a national security enabler, then one way of ensuring that is to establish some sort of military space organization, whether it's a space force, space corps, what have you.
I note that the EU has even got in on the act with their own international code of conduct for outer space activities. Thank goodness there's no decent acronym for that one, I don't think, anyway. How effective do these non-big players have a role in determining what happens in terms of the tranquility of space?
Well, unfortunately, the International Code of Conduct, which sadly is often referred to as the ICOC,
that's... there you go.
Yeah, so the ICOC was actually not seen as a successful document. So the EU proposed this in 2008. They put it forward really because they wanted to talk about responsible behavior in space. And because there seems to be a bit of a preference for these non-binding instruments for all the reasons that we've mentioned. But there was a bit of a pushback on that, excuse me, in particular by the smaller states, not the big players, but the ones who realize that they also have a vested interest in space, but they didn't hear their perspectives being taken into account. They thought the process was very EU and Western focused. And so the EU rectified that with a series of open consultations. And in 2014, they put another draft of this International Code of Conduct, this ICOC, forward. And they asked the UN to host the meeting, during which they wanted to really talk about the content of this document. And it just stalled completely on procedural matters, mostly because, again, the smaller states said, this is not representing the whole world. This is not the province of all humankind. This is the province of a few small number of powerful states. And also because it got a little bit politicized around the issue of whether or not the right to self-defense would be reiterated in this document, which is not even a necessary thing because that right to self-defense exists under international law. Excuse me. So it was the EU attempted to get in on it, but unfortunately it stalled because of all of these political pushbacks. So I think that what the takeaway from that really is that there is a desire to have more non-binding instruments, but it needs to be truly, truly multilateral. We need to have that international collaboration if we want it to be successful.
I do also note, Cassandra, that COPUAS, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, which since 1958 has included a wide variety of some of the smaller players, and perhaps one of the smallest I can think of is Australia, but we have been a member of that organisation since its inception in 1958.
Yeah, and a fairly active one. And I think there's actually a really exciting role for Australia to take right now in what's happening in space, especially given the fact that our space agency is so new, especially given the fact that there is more communication, although there needs to be more between defense and the space agency. We are in a really fantastic position. A lot of the world is watching Australia because of this mandate that the space agency has to support space industry. We're in a great position to be able to take a leadership role in terms of pushing for these norms, pushing for what is responsible behavior in space through COPUAS, through other UN bodies, through the General Assembly, and also just as an independent state that is now very much active in the space sector.
I imagine Australia's role in space, and I'm sure you can speak to this, Cassandra, will be more academic, industry-based, R&D, building relationships with perhaps our Pacific Island neighbours, that kind of thing.
There's definitely an important role for us in that sense. So capacity building, assisting our neighbours also in their ability to access space and benefit from space.
In what ways? Can you just speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, part of it is capacity building in the basic sense in what this podcast series is doing, educating people about our dependency on space and why it's important that we all are aware of what's going on. And also capacity building on the R&D side. So being able to share technology and train people up so that they have the wherewithal they don't necessarily need to be launching things into space, but if they're able to operate satellites, provide services, track satellites, some of our Pacific neighbors are really well placed to have ground stations that can be really important tracking stations. But I think Australia's role goes beyond what you might call R&D or capacity building, because we have a number of really fantastic companies that are really good at particular kinds of technology because we have been for many years already being able to service very remote areas with telecommunications, Earth observation that can assist in climate tracking, search and rescue, again, in remote situations. Space situational awareness as well, the ability to track what's in space. We have a lot of commercial entities who are really good at that, and defense has annual events, Space Fest, where it puts out calls and says, we want to see what industry is doing and see how we might be able to acquire and use some of that technology, because being aware of what's going on in space is extremely important. So space situational awareness is a key area of space operations in currently, but also in the coming decades. And that's an area that Australia really could be a world leader.
I'm so glad you brought us back to the original premise of today's conversations on the runway, utilising the word cooperation, not just necessarily conflict. I'm going to go, we're nearly out of time, but I want to go to both of you. Optimistic or pessimistic for the notion of conflict in space going into the future?
No, I'm cautiously optimistic. I feel that things are becoming very tangible with the launch of all the mega constellations, with the use of space for national security issues, for how space has been intertwined in our daily lives. And so I think just given how important it is, the international community, I think eventually we'll come together and find a way to make sure that everyone continues to get the benefits from use of space over the long term.
Cassandra.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I think the title of this particular episode has to do with cooperation in space, and we've talked more about competition, but space diplomacy is an important thing, and it happens a lot. It's not just at COPUAS, it's also between states themselves. And I think, you know, it's really heartening that commercial actors are starting to take their own initiatives in terms of what is responsible behavior, as Victoria has pointed out. And I think there's starting to be more of a public interest in space. People in general are starting to realize how important space is, and that's going to make a difference, because if you have a popular support for these issues being put on the table, then space diplomacy can actually take us further.
Who knows what our children and grandchildren, some of whom children, have been on the show today, which is wonderful. We're very family friendly here, as I said, on Conversations on the Runway. I want to thank our two wonderful guests, beaming in directly from the United States, Victoria Sampson, the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation. Thank you so much for your time, Victoria, and also our regular, becoming a regular guest, and very welcome to Cassandra Steer. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Conversations on the Runway, and we've been exploring key areas within air and space power. All views expressed by our podcast guests are their personal views and do not represent those of the Australian Air Force or the Department of Defence. Conversations on the Runway is brought to you by the Australian Air Force. Executive producer is Squadron Leader Kath Kennedy of the School of Postgraduate Studies. Sharpen your intellectual edge on Australia's air and space power by going to www.runway.airforce.gov.au.